Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome. Welcome to the first Codependents Anonymous National Convention. Congratulations to us. Yes. Congratulations to us. We're the lucky ones. Yes. We're the ones who have found there's actually a way of moving out of some of these self-defeating lifestyles that we've done for probably most of our lives. So it's really exciting to have you guys here today. So I'd like to welcome up the original CODA member in Australia, and she's going to talk to us today. So thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Shirley, and I'm recovering codependent. And I'm recovering from a few other things as well, a couple other fellowships. And I just want to take a moment. I'm very emotional now, so I'm not going to cry. I got my little tissue out. I just want to take a moment to take this in, because I've been all over the world for over 30 years, involved with 12-step fellowships. And we meet in places like this, artist halls, church basements, all over the world. And it's always, to me, the coming together of the common folk, the grassroots, the people standing up and saying, I'm in pain, I want out, I want help, where's the way? And what we have here in a 12-step fellowship is so divinely guided and blessed and so human and so practical and so caring and so loving and so painful at times as well. So I just want to acknowledge all of us for being here and being a part of this fellowship that's very much connected throughout the entire world. And I believe that I've just seen the anonymity of a 12-step program is not so much about, oh, I'm Shirley S., I don't want you to know I'm a codependent or whatever I am. It's more about when we come into this room, it doesn't matter if we are a bag lady on the street, if we're a multimillionaire, if we have a PhD, if we're running a garage or a mechanic, or it doesn't matter about what our life is out there. What matters is that we're all even and we're all equal. And it's one person helping another to try and have a good life, to recover from this disabling disease of codependency. And for that, to me, in all of the various spiritual practices, and I've done many, I'm from California, you know, we say we're the muesli, we're the granola capital of the world, the muesli capital of the world, the fruits, nuts, and flakes, we're all there, and so that's where I grew up and came from, and very multicultural place as well, and I've just seen that people coming together in 12-step fellowships with that anonymity, what it does is it drops the personality, it drops the ego part of us, and it allows us to connect. And with all the various spiritual practices and things and institutions and that I've been involved with and studied over the years, I have never, ever, ever felt the spirituality that I feel in a 12-step meeting. So that's why I'm feeling emotional. And that's why I'm very grateful to be here. So thank you for having me. And thank you for asking me. My journey of codependency recovery started before the word was ever invented. So I'll give you a little bit of history about it. 1978, I was already married to my second alcoholic husband. And I did not grow up in a house with alcoholism. So my parents, you know, were very minute social drinkers. We didn't have a lot of alcohol around us. So why was it that I was like 28 years old and on my second alcoholic husband? And how I knew is that he had about 5 drunk drivings, and I ended up in a treatment center on the family week with my 10-year-old daughter at the time, who's now 44. And go ahead. You're not hearing me properly.
No, it's just
okay, that's fine. There we go. Is that better? Great, thanks. And we were in here for the family week in the treatment center, and he was in for recovery from his alcoholism. And I remember relating. So if you think you've started up something here and trying to start something in a grassroots where there's not a lot of people and people look at you like, what are you? I was there with this group of people in Family Week, and of course we all bonded and everything. And guess what? Everyone there came from an alcoholic family. And my grandfather was alcoholic. So I had the emotional, genetic predisposition, but my father didn't. But he was like a dry drunk rager his whole life and very abusive. And so to describe his behavior, it was as crazy and as violent as a lot of people that grew up with alcoholic fathers back in that day. And yet I didn't have a reason for it, like, well, he was drunk. So I left there feeling the deep, dark secret that I had that was my bottom life line shame-based belief that I can articulate that to you today. I couldn't then, just felt it, of something's wrong with you. Something's wrong with you, Shirley, because all these people have a reason to be here. They grew up in an alcoholic family. Oh, yes, your dad was a hot-blooded German. Oh, yes, he was strict. But there's something wrong with me. And that was the secret I had inside of me. And I was desperately trying all of my life, trying to connect, to fit in, to have people approve of me, to be loved, to be part of the pack. You know, I never was part of the pack till I came to these rooms, really, that I was part of the pack. But there was so much more than being part of the pack, if you know, in these fellowships. So there I was. And at that time, we did not have the term codependent. I was the partner, the wife of an alcoholic. So they said, they looked at me and they said, you are a co. And I thought, I don't like that word. I don't want to be a co. I remember I'm a co what? And they said, you're a co-alcoholic. And if you would have been raised by an alcoholic father or mother, you would have been a para-alcoholic. And that was it. And then from the recovery days of sex, drugs, and rock and roll of the 60s and the early 70s, people started flooding into treatment more, and there was a lot. Drugs brought people to a bottom quicker than alcohol. And so these people were called chemically dependents. And they'd say, instead of just saying you're a drug addict, well, you're a chemical dependent. It could have been marijuana. It could have been, you know, speed, cocaine. It could be heroin. It could be anything. And alcohol is a drug. So instead of saying, well, you're an alcoholic and you're a drug addict, it started to become the professional catchphrase of, if anybody has a substance abuse problem, you are a chemical dependent. So guess what? The partners became codependents. And that's how the term originated, if you'd like to know. Thought you might like to know that. And so I was back there, one of these co's, you know, that before this term came about. And being in California in the 1980s and in the movement, and I was in another 12-step fellowship at the time, and I still am, but the whole codependency, adult children of alcoholics, ACA movement started at that time. And it was just like we'd have come to a meeting like this today, and a month later, there would almost be double the people. It was something from a swell of grassroots, of a purging of pain, that people were ready to come out and talk about. And so I was a part of that in San Diego, California, and learning and doing workshops and going to conferences and listening to speakers like Pia Melody. I've known Pia since 86, and I'm a friend and colleague today, and did training with her. And Pia, like many others in those early days, the family systems with Sharon Wegscheider-Cruz and these type of people, the understanding of bringing family systems and the alcoholic family and the family roles and the pain and the abuse, trauma, and neglect got born from family weeks in these treatment centers that the families would come of the addict, you know, the alcoholic, the drug addict. And then they would go home and these people would bust and drink again because everyone was enmeshed in the family disease. And yet, for the codependent like me, I think in my codependency is a lot incestuous and sicker for me of a disease and deep-rooted than my recovery from, I'm a recovering alcoholic, have been for over 30 years. So I actually got into AA through the back doors of Al-Anon and this type of work a few years later after that treatment center and the next divorce. Yeah, I was divorced twice by the time I was 29, and I thought, I think there's something in common with all this. It's me. And of course, the bottom line secret that I had that I didn't know I had, but I felt so deeply was, something's wrong with you, Shirley. Something. When you get it right, when you fix that thing that's wrong with you, then your life will finally iron out, straighten out. You know, I was the family scapegoat. I acted out everything. I broke out in rashes. I had eczema. I had this. I had that. I had all that stuff that's part and parcel somatically of this disease untreated. So painful as that was, it was lucky because even my deep codependency, my deep shame, my deep pain and those beliefs were purging out of my body. So it was trying, my body was trying to tell me, you know, we got to get a grip on this. Can't just medicate this. What caused it? I always wanted to know what caused it. So from that movement, I was like you, just very much in the early days, I couldn't get enough of it. I couldn't drink it in. I was finally putting pieces together of the puzzle that gave me an understanding to help me know that really I was okay. And I think that's all we all want to know, that I'm okay, I'm lovable, I'm worth loving, I have love to give, I have a contribution to make. I think that's a very human thing that we all want. And that's the only thing I wanted, just like anyone else. And I wanted to share it with other people, and I wanted to be a part of something. And I think what I wanted more was the family I never had. And the conversations, people listening to you, you listening to others deeply, sharing our experience, strength, and hope, sharing our pain, sharing our shame, sharing our joy, sharing our wins with each other and celebrating that. And that's what I found in 12-step programs. I remember that, you know, I used to belong in San Diego to an Alano Club. And Alano Club is a nonprofit. They have lots of them in the States. And it's a place for 12-step programs and 12-step people who want to recover. They have a lot of meetings in them. They rent them out. They're not affiliated with our 12 steps, as we're not with anyone. Yet they were a place that you could hang out with like-minded. And they would do fundraisers and fun things at the beach and dances. And I actually went through growing up in my adolescence in my 30s there. That's what I did. And I felt like all the things I wanted to do out of the innocent part of me and the purity without drinking, without drugging, without, you know, having to look good or be a certain way. And I could just be myself. And I remember if I went to a dance and anyone asked me to dance, I would dance. I would never say no to anyone. And I felt that spirit of that wounded, crushed adolescent inside of me start to come back and start to come alive. And she was in there. And she just wanted to have fun. And she just wanted to connect with everyone. And she just wanted to be part of the pack. That's what we do. And I was getting to heal that very deeply. Even though I wasn't 15 or 16 again, I was still getting to heal that very deeply. And along with some of the therapy I did and the 12-step work, it was just such a wonderful time. And I was growing in leaps and bounds, and I was starting professionally to run some groups like this, and very much in the grassroots therapy, as I'm a therapist, as I'm sure you all know. And I was just there a day at a time, loving it, learning, growing, healing, sharing, teaching, facilitating other people as well, and in those very early days. And I had dreams. I had visions. I wanted to make a contribution. I wanted to do things. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I couldn't have made a plan or a strategy. Let's have a business plan and plan this out. I followed the principles of this program. I surrendered. I went a day at a time. I took the next indicated step. I did all the things that our little cliches and programs said to do. And I had support, and I did two steps forward and one step back sometimes. But I was alive. I was so alive and passionate with this work. And I was saying to Guy, who picked me up at the airport last night, that when I got involved with 12-step programs, even back in that treatment center, I was 27, 28. Didn't think of it as bad, and I'll tell you a very interesting story. I think God, which is my higher power, I call God, has just such a mysterious way. I mean, I've just met people with the best stories I've ever heard in my life in these fellowships, and we're all such miracles, and we're all so interesting. And I was married to my high school sweetheart, fell pregnant, had a baby straight away, mother at 18 years old, and by the time I was 19, I was absolutely miserable, codependent, tight, controlling, up the yin-yang with my first alcoholic husband, who would, you know, come home from, he was a construction worker, drink a six-pack and be asleep by 7 o'clock on the couch, wouldn't let me work. Here I am, ADHD, you know, hyper, wanting to have a life, and I was miserable. I was just miserable. And where we were renting and living in California, there were some units behind us. And these people moved in that were bikers. And they looked scary. They looked like Hell's Angels. Tattoos and things. Tattoos weren't in then. And on these big Harleys. And I remember being scared by them at first, but curious. And the woman that was the husband and wife, we became friends and used to have our coffee together. And one day she said to me, because I was miserable and probably victim-y, whinging on about something and how my life was or my husband, or because that's what I did in those days. And she said to me one day, and I had known nothing about them or what you're doing. I thought maybe they did drugs or something. I didn't know what they did. Anyway, but she was nice and I liked her. I felt attracted to her. And she said, "What would happen to you if you lost everything, Shirley? What would you have?" And I'm thinking immediately material things, my house, my TV, we had meager few things. And I said, "Well, I'd have my daughter, my little dog, my husband, my mom and dad." You know, she said, no, let's imagine there was some horrible disaster and your family was wiped out and even your little dog was dead. You lost all your financial, what would you have?" And I looked at her and I said, "Well, I wouldn't have anything." And she goes, "Wrong, you'd have you." And I went, you know how you have these defining moments in your life? I was 19. That haunted me and haunted me. And I started talking to her, and she was a member of a 12-step fellowship, Narcotics Anonymous. And she started talking program stuff to me. No one had ever spoken these kind of things to me. And I couldn't get enough of it. And I would ask her questions, and I would say, "Well, where did you learn all this? We didn't have I'm 63. We didn't have psychology and all that stuff in those days." And I said, "Where did you learn all this?" She goes, "In a 12-step fellowship." And she said, "You can come along." I said, "But I don't do drugs," which I didn't. I didn't even drink then. And she said, "No, but it's a good program for living." So, of course, being a controlling Al-Anon codependent that I was, I enrolled my husband and got him to go. And the next thing you know, next week we're off to an NA meeting, you know. And I remember feeling it walking in the room. I didn't relate to their drug stories, but I related to what they were talking about. And they were talking about what was underneath the acting out. Because we act out. We act nuts, a lot of us. And so I remember, and I couldn't get enough of that. I was 19. The mother of one. So I always think my higher power had a plan. We hear my higher power has a plan for me. It's God's will. How the hell would I get in one of those places? I didn't have families that drink. They weren't even that many of them around. That was a real, you know, club you didn't tell anybody you went to. And everyone looked at these bikers like they were weird. I actually got into riding on the back of their Harleys. It was really fun. I loved it. So that was my introduction. And then we moved away, and then there was a divorce, and there was an ex-alcoholic husband, and then there was, you know, the treatment center and all that. And when we came back to all of that, I had already had seeds planted. When I got sober, when I went on to CODA, when I went on to ACA, all of these things, I already had very deep seed planted. I didn't walk into a 12-step meeting thinking, you know, like a dog with their tail between their legs, thinking, "Well, I've really hit the bottom now." You hear a lot of people say that. Here I am with all these no-hopers whinging about their life. And I didn't walk in there feeling that. I felt like I was divinely guided and blessed. I thought, no. This is a good place. This is where people come and they're honest. This is where people help each other and they help themselves. This is where people find a way in their life. And I have always felt that about 12-step programs. I have always felt blessed and lucky to be a member of any of the 12-step fellowships that are appropriate to me, and just so much a part of it. So here I am in my little haven in San Diego, California, with colleagues that were in recovery, colleague meetings, friends in recovery, CODA meetings, ACA, AA, just a mecca in Southern California of all of this. And I'd found my life, and this is about 5 years I was humming in all of this, loving it, and growing and learning. And then guess what? It's like my higher power picked me up and dropped me in Australia. My daughter met an Aussie who was on holidays, and she was 18, and Mom, I'm going off, you know, to marry Peter and come to Australia, and I need you to come for the wedding. And I was going to be moving to Sedona, Arizona, and I had been doing in-service and lectures in treatment centers there. I was doing public workshops on codependency there in Sedona. I had a hot lover, Italian lover in Sedona, and I was going to do all this and move to Sedona, but I had that bloody wedding in November I had to get to my daughter, and then I'd come and move from California. And that's the first time I ever thought of moving anywhere. And so I did, and I came for the wedding, and it is as if a couple of months before I come, everything dried up. It's like all the doors started closing. And then I knew colleagues said, oh, when you get to Australia, you must look up so-and-so. You must see them and tell them what you're doing. And I was in this country for a week, did my daughter's wedding, went to a counseling center in Brisbane, the Barden Counseling Center. And the director there, Ann Allenson, said to me, I told her what I did. And I was just me. I just wanted to meet people. Hi, hey, this is what we're doing in America. This is what are you doing here? And just kind of share information. And she said to me, I know what you're doing, and I want you to do it here. And I said, oh, well, okay. She said, I'll tell you what. She said, the book Woman Who Loved Too Much was out. And she said, seen people go to a talk on it, and women queued up around the block. And she said, this is something. She said, I want to be the first center in Australia. I want to beat Sydney. And I want to be that's what she said. And I'm going, okay, I'm just here, I'm in Australia, I hadn't even been to Sydney, I have no idea what the rest of Australia was like. I was in Brisbane in 1988, so take that picture, the whole town dried up, the only thing that was open was the Meyer Center, if you wanted to go near people, and so, on Sundays, and so I said, oh, okay, and she said, I'll promote you, I'll get you, and the next thing you know, there I am being interviewed by the press, on the local television station, on the radio, doing talk back. I've never done this, and so there you go. And boom, a week before Christmas, we were having codependency workshops at that center, and people were lined up and groups. And so I stayed here. I got promoted to come to the, sponsored to be in the country. That all went through like an employer nomination scheme. I went over to the States. I'm grieving. I'm going to leave my friends. Oh, my God. I thought I was only going to be here for 6 months. And now I'm moving over. And look, there was no internet. It cost about $100 to talk 20 minutes on the phone. How long do I have? Halfway through. Thanks. Thank you, love. I used to send my best buddy in recovery, my girlfriend, we'd send cassette tapes. I would get them 3 weeks later, couldn't wait, put them on, lay in bed at night at midnight, listen to them, and find out somebody died in a fellowship and sat there crying by myself. So there I was again by myself, nobody to connect with that knew this stuff. AA was really, really behind with drunk a lot. I mean, it was really hard. And I'm like, I was kind of mad at my higher power. I mean, I have free will. I could just say, screw this, I'm going home. But I felt like I was supposed to be there, and I was enjoying the work. But my personal life, it was lonely. There I was, back to where I was when I started. Where's my tribe? Where's my connection? Where's my people? And I went through a depth of loneliness that I hadn't quite hit. And you know, they say, I remember years and years ago, I heard John Bradshaw share in a lecture I attended, and he said, in all the stages of grief and all the feelings we feel and the shame, and you know, his claim to fame is bringing shame public and talking about it. And he said, when people hit the loneliness, that's when they want to bail. Because that depth of loneliness brings up the deep abandonment pain. It brings up that, if I'm so wonderful or I'm a good person, why am I feeling like this? Why am I not surrounded by family and friends who love me? Why am I not being validated and approved of? And that's what I was feeling. It was that gut-level loneliness. And it was through work and being able to talk to clients and seeing clients that really wanted healing and to know this stuff, and I knew that's where I was too, that I connected. Not that I used clients for my healing, it was just I wasn't connected. There was no professionals I could connect to. They were bloody sicker than my clients. Let me tell you, if I could tell you some of the stories that went on behind those closed doors, but I won't, but I think you probably know or get it. And I just, it was my clients. They were the people because they were like me. They wanted it. They were humble. They were hungry for it. So when I'm back home, packing up, feeling, look, I can give this a go. I can always come home. It just was happened. It was so clear I was supposed to be here. And while I'm there, Anne calls me up and she says, Shirley, I've got a psychiatrist here and she's really interested in what you're doing and she's coming over for a holiday to the States. Can you take her to a conference or something? And I'm like grieving, thinking the last thing I want to do is take somebody to a conference. I didn't even know where a conference was. And yet everyone had been so gracious and wonderful to me here and to be able to reciprocate. I said, well, of course, let me see what I can find out. And there was. There was this big ACA conference. And my girlfriend, by the way, was the editor of a paper called, wrote the movie reviews in Sober Times. And when I came back from Australia, she said, oh, my friend Shirley's been over in Australia working with codependency. And they said, can we interview her? And I thought, what the hell? I wasn't trying to create business because I was leaving. So I was like, sure. It was always like, sure, I'll share what I know, and open-hearted and told them all about it. And that was that. And then there was this ACA conference. I didn't even attend the speakers. I was grieving, and I was downstairs where they had all the tables and the pavilions and the books for sale. And my sponsor had told me, I told her how lonely I was, and she said, you're going to have to find some way to connect. You're going to have to find somebody in some way to connect. So I'm breezing by the tables here, and I see these two magazines. And one's called Focus, and one's called Changes. They were recovery magazines. One was for therapists and one was for just people, 12-steppers. So I go to the guy, and this is like a scene out of a movie. I go to the guy, I say, oh, I said, can I get these shipped overseas? Because you know what it was like back then to even ship anything overseas. Oh, man, don't do that. You know? And so he said, oh, well, where are you, where to? And I said, because I'm thinking, well, I can read these and feel connected to the recovery movement there, because there was no movement here. And I said, in Australia. And he looked at me, it was like out of a movie. He goes, oh my God, you're that woman. And I jumped. I thought, shit, they found out something's wrong with me, you know. And I said, what do you mean? What? And he said, you're the woman in the Sober Times. We were having breakfast, my business partner and I today. And he said, we opened up that paper and he read that article. He goes, I'm going to find that woman while I'm here in San Diego. I can't, stay here. Can you, oh, I'm so-and-so. Here's my card here. Let me, don't move. Gets this part. Hi, I'm you know, and can you tell us about Australia? And he says, we publish these magazines. I'm thinking of the local news agent here, right? Go, I don't think they're ready for this. And he said, can I have lunch with you? And can you tell me about Australia? We want to do business there. And I said, sure. So the next day we went for lunch. I'm talking to Gary Seidler, who's the president of Health Communications Books, who had been publishing John Bradshaw's books and all these recovery books. I had no idea who he was. And as we're having lunch, he's telling me their story. They originated from Canada. And he said, as we're speaking, our books, all of our recovery books are on the water on the way to Australia with the distributor. And he goes, I bet you've got a good story. Let me introduce you to my publisher. You can write a book in Australia. And I'm sitting here, I didn't write a book. I wrote one magazine article once, and I'm a speaker. And I smiled, and my heart's beating. And there was this big conference. It was the first conference on codependency in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I remember looking at it thinking, oh, God, I'd love to go there. I couldn't afford it. You know, I was packing up. I hadn't been working, going to back to Australia. I had no money. I'm getting rid of everything. Last thing I would do is fly to Arizona, stay in a hotel, and attend a conference. And he's telling me about this conference. And he says, and what we're going to do is we're going to get all the people together we're going to come up with one definition of codependency. He said, I'd like you to come to the conference and be my guest. And he said, I'd like you to be at that meeting, and I'd like you to be the Australian person. And you can be on the ground, and we're going to do seminars in Australia, and I'll have you be the keynote speaker for Australia. And I'm just like, you know, it's like me. And there I am the following week having lunch with Ann Wilson Schaaf, Sharon Wegscheider Cruz, John Bradshaw, as we're all putting our two bobs in to come up with a unified definition on codependency. And I remember my sponsor saying, don't you understand that this is your group? And that's what your higher power has put you. And my ego was like, I can't do this. And oh my God. And I was so nervous. And that's what happened. So I came over here and wrote Set Yourself Free in 4 months. Lonely, sitting in paradise on Pittwater, you know, at Clairville Beach. And what I basically did was pull together what I'd been doing for the last 10 years in my life and what I knew to be true and what my story was. And they gave me an Australian writer to help me, Shelley Neller, and she helped me with Australianisms and putting it down. And in 4 months, I put that book together, and it was launched. And that launched my career in business here. But more importantly, I was being interviewed a lot on the radio. And I was just seeing people one-on-one and running a little group therapy or something. And I felt this big responsibility to, you know, you get on the radio, they ask you these questions, you talk. I did a lot of talk back. It would drop people into their pain because somebody started speaking the story and validating what was going on inside of them. And I felt very responsible to drop people into their pain. And then what do they do? I couldn't go to an AA meeting. So when I had been over there, I got the starter packets for Codependence Anonymous. I gave them to some people, Lorraine W., who was a member of Al-Anon and in Sydney, and she was one of my clients, and I gave them to her and her family, and they started, and I told them the setup, how it was to AA and Al-Anon similar, but they had their own preamble and everything. And we had some literature, some American brochures that talked about the problem and the solution. And the very first Codependence Anonymous meeting was in Neutral Bay at the community center there. And they used to have a Thursday night, and that started branching out and growing. People in other fellowships caught wind of it, people for off the street, people that heard me on the radio. People used to say, Shirley's going to try to her business through 12-step programs, and I don't do that. That's not what you do in the fellowship. But I tell you what, I feel the rooms of 12-step programs from the work that I've done. And for that, I feel humbly privileged. And that's why I say it's a God job. I don't care what you're doing. And I'm talking about a business that's related to what we're doing here in our disease. I'm not meaning it in a business format. But whatever is going on with you, from relationships to a business, to a life, to healing with your family, your kids, your parents, your siblings, and finding yourself in your life, to whatever that is, you can find the answer following these steps. We're lucky. You know, it's always a surrender. There's always the next surrender. It's probably the only lesson there really is. My biggest lesson was get out of my own way. Every time I've got out of my own way, and maybe followed a passion, not a fear, didn't try to orchestrate it all, didn't try to have the divine plan, and did my footwork. You have to do your footwork. Your footwork in recovery and your footwork for whatever you're doing on whatever the project is or the thing that you're doing. That's really important as well. That's a grown-up thing to do. That's what functional adults do. And we do the boring things. I talk about adults are dull. I talk about that and Set Yourself Free. And it's like we can fall back on, this is what I know how to do, and I can do it. And it's that spirit of the adolescent inside of us, that child inside of us. When we heal the wounds, it's like the life force comes back. The creative ideas. Maybe I couldn't do those ideas the way I wanted to do them when I was 18 because I might have been 35 and had a couple of kids and circumstances were different. But if you take the essence of the passion of what you did, someone told me once, if you go back to finding, and this is when you get underneath the pain and the hurt, wounded child and the adapted parts of you, and you get to start to get to that essence of that joy. If you can go back to a time in your childhood that you can remember what you loved doing, the theme of that, how did you feel your hours? What were your dreams? If you were lost, you probably had a lot of fantasies, a lost child. If you were a scapegoat, I don't know, maybe you didn't realize them. If you were too much caretaking or the hero, you might have been pushed or driven into something that wasn't the real you. But if you can go back when there wasn't any pressure or even in your secrets of what you wanted to do and enjoyed, there's probably kernels of that for you right now in some way in your life. You're going to laugh. I go back to this theme of being lonely. I was always lonely. I had one sister 6 years older. I was the brat that came along. We were physically abused. We had a lot of crap in our family, as a lot of us do, a lot of wounding. And I was just lonely. I felt so different to all of this group, and I was just wanting to connect. And I used to have dolls in my room. I had a doll collection as a little girl, every kind of doll you can imagine. And I, like a lot of people would say, well, you're playing with your Barbie dolls and dreaming of teenage things, or you've got your baby dolls and you're going to become a mother and all of that. That's not what I did with my dolls. And nobody knew this. And I forgot. I went back, and you'll laugh. I went back to, I said, what did I used to do and spend hours doing, and what did I love? I used to sit with those dolls. They all had a name. They all had a different personality, and they all had a problem. You talk about play therapy for children. It's very powerful, and it works. If you know anybody that does this, I know some people in Sydney. And they used to, one by one, we would discuss every one of their problems, and then I would give them a solution. And nobody knew that I did that. I was the only, and it was kind of one of those moments that dawned on me. It's kind of like, well, that's a blinding flash of the obvious, and that was a BFO. It's like, shit, I've been doing this forever. So, you know, you look at some of those passions, and then I was very creative and expressive and dance and theater. So a lot of my work has been molded around, like I used to think, why should we all go into recovery and drone? You know, sure, there's that pain and that's very serious and we do need that validated and we do need to heal and we need that watershed. Yet if we can't do what the promises say in step 9, you know, I've got this notion of alchemy. Once you've done your grief work, once you've done your original pain work and got a lot of that out of the way, and you're already on the road to forgiveness and forgiving yourself, and you're on the road to that, you know, self-love, the step 9 says we do not wish to close the door. You know, we do not regret the past, and we do not wish to close the door on it. And it's like, everyone says that, but it's kind of like, well, it would have been nice if I had Steven Spielberg for my father, you know, when I'm sat around the dinner table and we all discuss things. There was these regrets. There are these, wouldn't it have been nice if? What if that flipped around and it was like, no, my life, everything that happened, every shitty thing, the abuse, the sexual abuse, the physical abuse, the control, the missed opportunities, the unfulfilled dreams, the shattered relationships, everything in my life. What if I could, and I like this notion of alchemy. You take something that's lead, let you go, this is worthless. And how do you go through a chemical process that's actually quite mystical as well and turn it into gold? That's what the alchemist did. The alchemist took the lead and turned it into gold. Jesus turned water into wine. You know, these are kind of things of alchemy. And if you can start to do the, you know, healing work, or a lot of you, I'm here, sure, here, have done a lot of the healing work. You know what I'm talking about. and you get to that place, it's not a head decision. I see a lot of people that come in and they say, oh, but you know, my parents had it worse than me, and I was probably naughty, and, you know, it was awful, and, you know, they did the best they could. Yeah, they probably did have it worse than you. They probably did do the best that they could. They probably did love you. They probably did screw up a lot and be abusive a lot or leave out a lot of things or a lot of neglect. And what was the impact on you? That's the part you have to heal. It's not about blaming. To the degree that you blame is to the degree that you'll always stay a victim, and there'll be that little bit of regret. Oh, if only. If only. I don't want to live my life in an if only. And trust me, there's been a lot of hurtful, horrible, abusive things in my past. And I've done a lot of abusive things. And, you know, to forgive yourself, to forgive others, you cannot do it without going through all of the feelings, the anger, the pain, the shame, the fear, all of it, and processing it and having it validated, but not wallowing in it. A lot of people get addicted to feeling and in the intensity. They act out their feelings. The profoundness and the deepest healing that comes in this journey, I can tell you, for over 30 years, has not been through intensity. Oh, I've had some intense moments, and I've had therapists and people along the way that encouraged me to be intense. It didn't really get me anywhere. It just speeded up my brain and made it worse. I've had people that say, you know, beat the sawhorse forever. Well, I was a rager like my dad because I learned to pump adrenaline through my body so I wouldn't have to feel the powerlessness and the fear and the terror that was inside of me from the abuse that I had. And all of those things are survival techniques. We all learn survival techniques to just get on until they don't work anymore. That's the dark day for all of us. It just doesn't work anymore. You just feel so sad or so depressed or so hopeless, and you're wondering about, you know, I love it in a 12-step meeting. People say, I had thoughts of suicide. And it's like, people say, oh my God, out in the world, when you have a 12-step meeting, anybody here ever had a thought of suicide? Everyone's like, oh yeah. It's like, okay, let's just get on with it. Doesn't mean we're going to do it. It's just, it's a cry. It's like, I don't think I can live with this anymore. Thank you. And so all of these things, you know, I don't care if you have no money, you're a single mother, you have a lot of money, there is a way. If you are sincere, if you surrender to this program, if you get yourself out of your own way and a day at a time you follow these simple steps, what will happen is it'll be like the Red Seas get parted, your higher power will pick you up and put you somewhere. Like, I couldn't have sat back there in California. I had people over there, colleagues that were way beyond me in a knowledge base and in years, that had written books and couldn't get them published. I'm over here getting a publisher on me, write a book, what would I say about you? I don't write a book. It's just, you just end up in places, you end up in situations, and then you know what you have to do? You have to front up. You have to fear forward. I talk about that in my book. I say, take a deep breath and fear forward. You know, it's if you want the goodies in life, if you want to do it, you have to pull up that courage inside of you. And there's always a little bit and there's always more. So you have to do that and take that step if you want to have those things, because we have free will. Our higher power goes, here, you want to come to Australia? I could have went, no, I'm not going there. Weird people over there. I want to go home and to my little cushy recovery group. And there I would still be. But my higher power said, well, maybe you'll touch some people here. Maybe you'll be touched, Shirley. Maybe I'll hear that loneliness that I wasn't able to heal over there. So I had to actually be dropped right here to go through that, because I was never going to do it. I was too cushioned there. I'd found my tribe. I was happy. I was so angry with God. I found my tribe, and now here I am. And I had free will, and I knew I was supposed to be here. Did you ever know when you're supposed to be somewhere in a situation, in a healing thing, and you don't want to be there? Anybody? Oh, yeah. I don't want to be there. This is not my group, you know. And I knew that. So I kept taking a deep breath, and I kept fearing forward, and I kept taking the next indicated step, as they say in the program. Those principles I got here, they're simple, they're continuous, you have to do them consistently, you don't rest on our laurels, as they say, they're profound. The miracles happen in the simplicity. A lot of times they're quiet. You know, I spent years trying to get my father to approve of me. We fought, and when I finally, in every bit of me, let it go, and I didn't need him to tell me I was wonderful or say what I was doing was wonderful, I let it go. It's like our whole relationship shifted and it turned around. In his older years, both my parents are deceased now, but when I would call him up, you know, and I'd done all my healing work with him, he'd say, "Honey, are you happy? Just be happy. I'm so proud of you. Look what you've done." And no one in the family ever told you to do that. You can do whatever you want to do, sweetheart. I would have hung out, bled to have my father say that to me in my 30s. So when you don't need it anymore, because I could say it to myself, and I didn't have to get it. Now, that could be from the next husband, the next people I work with, the colleagues, whoever, that has to tell me I'm okay. We all like a compliment. We all like to be acknowledged. I certainly like to be acknowledged for the work that I do and what I've done, and it's lovely, and I'm appreciative, but I don't need it. I'm not hanging out for it. That's the difference. The need between I want that, it's nice. As I started with this, most people want to feel connected. They want to feel loved. They want to give love. They want to make a contribution. And it's in ourself to observe our creations, what we do. And it's that simple. And we keep doing that over and over. It's like, what's the next sandcastle I'm building in the sandbox? You can go back to that. Do I want to go to somewhere else and do one? Do I want to do it with another group of people? What can I learn? What am I doing on this journey? I am so grateful that at 19, my higher power opened an opportunity for me to attend my first 12-step meeting when I didn't do a drug or drink. And I am so thankful for that. And I'm so thankful that there was some spirit in me that enrolled my husband to drag him down there and walk through those doors and walk through the doors of the next program and the next program and the next program and get on the plane and fly to Sydney and do the next thing and the next thing. That took my spirit and my willingness, but it was my higher power that opened it up and said, "Would you like to do this?" Without any judgment. There's no judgment. God is not made in the image and likeness of us. We try to make God in the image and likeness of us. That's why a lot of us hate God. It's like, man, you know. So I got my time's up. I just am so honored. I'm going to be moving back to the States later next year, and I'm so honored to be at this very first codependency convention. And look at you guys. You're in Bangalore. Look at you. And it's like me in Brisbane back in 1988. And it's like you can do this anywhere if you've got passion, spirit, and a willingness, and you keep showing up. This can grow and grow and grow and be a wonderful network of support and fellowship and friendship. So thank you so much for having me. God bless you, everyone. God bless us.